I think we should be very careful about artificial intelligence. If I were to guess at what our biggest existential threat is,
it's second probably is a revolutionary moment.
Hey, how does the man
Bill?
What the breaches in the rocket cylinder drove its mill. I can give you no authoritative information either to their nature, their origin, or their purposes here on Earth.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Creator Futurism. This is John Best.
And this is Kevin J. Anderson.
And Kevin J. Anderson, we talk about how the future and how all this technology comes together and how it's very thrilling about what you write about, how it comes true. And right now, we usually do this together, but you're not with me right now. Where are you?
Well, we're using technology as in like connecting through Zoom so we can do this. But it's sort of an interesting thing that I'm writing about, you know, really high tech science fiction and futurism and all kinds of things like that in my writing. But there comes a time when you just need to sort of unplug and get away from it all so you can actually get work done. So I've had to sort of hole up in a metaphorical room with no windows and pull up the drawbridge. I'm in a mountain cabin up in the Colorado mountains, surrounded by a bunch of aspen, a little bit of snow on the ground. It's a beautiful, perfect place, but there's not very good phone service and not very good internet service, which is wonderful because it lets me concentrate on things. And I got like 100 pages edited yesterday, 100 pages edited the day before, and I have a killer deadline coming up in a couple of days. So I just needed to drop off the face of the earth. But I am emerging to record a podcast because we've got a great guest, and it took a while to arrange all three of our schedules. So I am becoming technologically able again for just an hour or so, and then I drop off the face of the earth once more.
So can I ask what you're writing on? Am I allowed to ask what you're working on at the moment, or is that like something that's got to be under wraps?
Well, it's a really big fantasy novel that I have, so I guess it's not as science fiction. I'm in a more medieval mindset with swords and dragons and magic and stuff right now.
Being in the woods is the perfect
700 page manuscript. Yep.
So it's your version of Game of Thrones.
I will turn mine in on time though. So there is that extra little. George is a good friend of mine, as I think most people know. Going back to lower technology, where in fact here's a segue with the fantasy stuff, because I just watched a really terrible movie. I don't recommend it. It's King Arthur, Legend of the Sword or something like
that. I saw your tweet about that. You did not seem like you liked it.
Oh, it was actually not a terrible fantasy movie. It just had absolutely nothing to do with King Arthur. But here's the thing that I want to bring up, which will lead us into our guest today, that there's a little conversation where like they're in the bar and they're talking about getting other people to join their revolution. And they said, well, we should get Bill to join because he can help out. And they went, Bill the Potter's son, or Bill with the one finger, or Bill with who makes tapestries, or Bill the guy who cheats at cards. And they were arguing over which Bill they were talking about, because that just wasn't a very good way to identify people in the Middle Ages. You had townspeople who had jobs and they all had the same name of, you know, Mary or Bill or Tom or whatever. And our guest today is going to talk a whole lot about personal identity and who we actually are. So I will use that as a very well-planned segue to punt over to you, John, for a brief introduction.
Yeah, thank you. So brief introduction. Many years ago, I bumped into this guy named Drummond Reed. And Drummond said, John, you got to come out to this workshop. And at the time, I was working on the idea that I just didn't like passwords. I really have a problem with that. You know, we've talked about it before on this show. And I was invited out to something called the Internet Identity Workshop, which was interesting. It was held in basically Silicon Valley, Mountain View. And it was held at the Computer History Museum, which, by the way, they had me at Computer History Museum. And it was in the top, and it was this weirdo kind of, not weirdo, it was an unconference. And I don't know if you've ever been to one of those, Kevin, but it's a conference where there is no agenda. And this young lady who was helping to run the conference kind of popped up, and she did just a spectacular job of sort of helping get everybody together. And also there were some newbies like myself in the audience and sort of explaining what the Internet Identity Workshop was and just identity in general. I ran into her just recently at the W3C, which the W3C is one of the governing bodies of the internet. They create a lot of the cool features that we see, you know, how you can pretty much play a video anywhere on the internet now is thanks to the W3C. So please join me in welcoming Kalia, Identity Woman, which, by the way, is kind of a superhero thing. So hi, Kalia.
Hey, John.
So Kalia, welcome. And you are the Identity Woman. You've told me of your superpower before, but give the audience a little bit about you and your background.
Sure. Sometimes I say my superpower is explaining all of this identity stuff, the technical work that's being done to everyday people. I've been working for the last 15 years on supporting the emergence of another layer of the internet that really puts people at the center of their own identities and their own data lives, so that we are empowered as human beings with rights and dignity, and that to make sure that we have that, we need some new protocols and technical capabilities to be innovated. And that's what a lot of what happens at the Internet Identity Workshop that we convene twice a year is to support the community of those technical innovators working to solve the challenge of how we really empower individuals with their own digital identities.
See, Kevin, I told you she was speaking your language. Did you hear her talking about being human and having dignity? That sounds like you all over again.
Yeah, I think humans should have dignity, and basically, you know, we are our identity, right? So if somebody steals our identity, then obviously somebody has stolen our soul. Effectively, that's who we are. But this is it's a different situation from what. Look, throughout history, there have always been people who have, you know, pretended to be somebody else, whether they were spies or they might steal the royal seal so that they could make fake imperial proclamations or something like that. So that, I mean, stealing identity has been around forever, but now it's so vastly more insidious, because what our identity is in different pieces all over the place. And it's, you know, it's our Safeway card knows what groceries we're buying, and our credit bureaus know every bill that we were a week late on and stuff. So, and that's just things that are happening by themselves. And if somebody's insidiously trying to become John Best to steal his dozens of dollars in the bank account, then it becomes really scary. So I think we're at a real important cusp, and I'll shut up and let you talk, Kalia, about how do we create an identity that is protected and is sincerely ours, so that we are who other people think we are.
Well, those are two separate questions. That's one of the things we learn about this world of identity is that the questions get divided up into smaller pieces. But we could start with the first one, which is how do we create this layer where people really own and control their own digital identities? And one way to start accessing that is to think about the options that we had up until recently to do this. So one way we created digital identities was to go to various service providers and create a username in their namespace. So we all have these types of accounts, a Gmail address, a Facebook account, a LinkedIn, a Twitter handle, and the list goes on and on and on. So anytime you go on the web and you go to somebody's website and you create a new account, you're creating an identity within their namespace that they ultimately own and control. They have the right to terminate those identities. And we, as the human beings that created those, have very few rights, if any, no recourse to address, like, if those accounts are terminated. And if we think about how sort of what happens in the physical world, there's a bunch of laws that we have created as a civilization that address this challenge with our physical bodies. It's not okay to terminate someone's physical being without significant consequences or harm that physical being. That's assault, right? So why in the digital realm is it okay to just terminate my digital self with no recourse or rights, basically?
Yeah, where they just sort of cut you off, right?
Right.
Because that person has made an arbitrary decision that your account no longer exists, or – you know, yeah. or what that looks like. And one of the challenges that we see, you know, quite frequently as being people that conduct business on the internet, which, you know, Kevin, that's you and I really, is, you know, how often you're trying to really prove who you're dealing with on the other end and how that third party trust, which I think is what you're kind of revealing to us here, isn't necessarily, you know, trustworthy. And so it's all about whatever source that validates whoever that is, right?
Well, so I'm not talking even about that yet, Don.
Oh,
I'm
wow. Just you're even higher level than that.
The anchor of where that digital self exists as a starting point, right? So there's this sort of where do we begin to anchor? And another set of choices we have is we could anchor our digital identities in globally managed namespaces. So one option is to go get a domain name and set up an email account with under that. And set up a homepage. And many, many people do that these days, but you're still within the DNS hierarchy and you have to pay a fee every year for the right to use that domain name. And then you could also be in the phone system. So the phone number numbering system is globally managed by an institution called the ITUT, and you can rent a phone number from a phone company, but it's ultimately not yours. It's owned in this system. So the cool thing about what's happened finally with the community gathering at the Internet Identity Workshop is we've had a breakthrough to support individuals creating globally unique identifiers for themselves that only they control and manage and that are findable in a global context. So that we've had a breakthrough, and this type of identity is called self-sovereign identity. So this is very, very new. And within the next year, hopefully there will be products and services that regular consumers can access to create self-sovereign identities and use them.
Interesting. So someone like Kevin, let's say Kevin wanted a self-sovereign identity. So Kevin is a famous writer. So, you know, when I look at his Twitter account, one of the coolest things about Kevin is he has that cool little symbol next to his name, which means he's important, like the seal that.
Oh, but I just got that.
I know.
I just got that though. It took years, and I had to send all this paperwork because there are other. Well, you've seen it yourself that if there's a famous author or a famous actor, there are all kinds of people that just put in a Twitter account up with that person's name. There's the real Donald Trump, but I think there's probably hundreds and hundreds, if not more, of people that call themselves Donald Trump on Twitter. But there are lots of other authors, like Brandon Sanderson had dozens of people that called themselves Brandon Sanderson. So he had to get blessed by Twitter to say, this is the real Brandon Sanderson. And I had asked for it about 5 or 6 years ago. And they said, you're not important enough. Nobody's going to take your identity. And nobody has, as far as I know. But I thought, come on, guys, I really need to be the real person because I interact a lot from my own social media. And I have all these people that just assume that it's not me, that it's just some bot or it's a low paid assistant who just makes up these brilliant things that I'm saying. But I actually went back to Twitter and I said, you know, look, I've got 25,000 people in the various things. I've had 140 books published. I've got all these bestsellers. Can you really, don't think that I deserve the little verified account thing? And they did. It wasn't like I had to get nasty with them or anything, but so I had to do that. But I also know another famous author whose Twitter account got hijacked. It was her real Twitter account. And I think it was a disgruntled employee or an old assistant or something who hijacked it and was posting like really nasty stuff in the author's out of the author's mouth for a long time. And there was like a lawsuit with Twitter because Twitter wouldn't take down the fake person because it had been verified as her. So all of this stuff is a little bit concerning to those of us who might get noticed by people.
Right. And so what I was saying, and that's exactly why I brought this up, was so in a new self-sovereign world, Kalia, how does that work for Kevin? Like, you know, for someone like him who needs to be validated as him and it's powerful and useful to his...
This is, again, where we're like, we need to pull the threads apart, right? So a starting point is just having a a technical, like an addressable technical address, right? Which a Twitter handle is an address for you, Kevin, right? So
right.
The self-sovereign identity tools and systems are starting with supporting individuals having any number of these digital anchor points that they literally own and can manage and control. And then the question is, what do we want to build with that new infrastructure? Because it's almost like, you know, with the evolution of our digital systems, we had the protocols that created the internet, the nodes being able to talk to each other, TCP, IP, decades before we had the protocols that expressed web pages on using those same protocols, right? And so now we're having a next generation of protocols for expressing digital identities, and they have a lot more richness and expressive capacity, just like the web added to the richness and expressive capacity you could send over the internet. Before, it was just like files and email.
Interesting.
So this next evolution of the web is about an infrastructure for identity. And now there's another question is, what would a Twitter-like service using this infrastructure look like? And what would verified claims look like in the context of that infrastructure, right? So you, Kevin, could get a self-sovereign identity, and other people who wanted to quote unquote follow you would also have their own self-sovereign identities. And your self-sovereign identity anchor points in this digital network could directly connect to their self-sovereign identity. And in a way, I think we could end up with services like Twitter and Facebook being disintermediated, because you no longer need to be subject to the terms of service and conditions of Twitter to send messages to people, right? So and particularly in the case of Facebook, I'm not a Facebook user myself, but my understanding of how it's ended up evolving is that individuals who have things to share with the world and maybe services that they offer or products that they sell, that Facebook, instead of sending the messages that they post to all of the people who follow them, only send it to 10% of those people. And then you have to pay Facebook to get to the rest of them. Are you kidding me? Like,
you understand it perfectly.
Right?
It's terrible.
So with self-sovereign identity, if you can find the person you want to follow, you make a direct connection between the technical name is a decentralized identifier, and their decentralized identifier. And in theory, we should be able to, you know, if you wanted to broadcast to all your followers, they should get your message.
Yeah. And Kevin, why don't you talk a little bit? Because I know you've been struggling with this lately. You know, I could hear your voice anyways.
We just had a one of our previous episodes, I forget exactly, it was a couple of weeks ago or something, that I talked about exactly with Facebook, where I have three different Facebook pages, and altogether they've got like 18,000 people who are my followers. These are people that actively went out of their way to say, I want to go to Kevin's page and see what he has to say.
Yeah.
But when I post on that page and say, I'm doing a book signing in Portland, Oregon at such and such a date, Facebook says 219 people reached. Would you like to boost this post? And I get like really annoyed, because if it's like me subscribing to a newspaper, but they only send me the news every once in a while.
Well, it's actually more like you bought a classified in a newspaper and they said, yeah, we'll send this to 200 of them, but if you want the rest, it's even more.
Exactly. Right. Well, and I've talked, it sounds kind of like old and crotchety, but I say that I miss MySpace, because on MySpace, I had 15,000 followers and I would put something up there and all 15,000 of them could look at it. And I thought that that was very useful. But one of the subjects of what we were talking about in a previous podcast was how I am actively, in a much more primitive way, but I'm doing exactly what you were talking about, Kalia, that I'm trying to build up my own mailing list and readers group and the people that that so that I have a direct contact with them. And when I want to send out, here's a free short story, or here's a reprint of something that you can have, or here's my list of book signing schedules and convention appearances, that I actually send it to the people who have self-identified as the ones who want to read it. Everybody's on Facebook. So everybody, that seems to be the place to contact people. But it's an illusion, because when you put something up there, you think all everybody can see it, and they can't. And you can't specify who gets to see it. They just pick them by the third letter alphabetically or something. I don't know.
So let's talk about some other use cases. So one thing I know, Kalia, that you do is you get hired to come and, you know, start to explain this to organizations that are beginning to adopt this or trying to be in the forefront of adopting this. Can you talk a little bit about the sorts of gigs that you have and the use cases you've seen and the popular sort of mentality? Why are people looking at this and why do they care?
Yeah, so folks are looking. I think this speaks to the next piece of the challenge that you articulated too, Kevin, which is there's this challenge of sharing information from third parties whose business it is to know something about someone, right? And a very simple example is that, you know, I just spent the last 2 years doing a master's degree at the University of Texas. It was in identity management and security. And so now I'm a graduate of that school, and they are going to issue me a certificate. And I can ask them for transcripts that go over what I took and what my grades were. And right now, the only way that I can prove that is by them sending me, or whoever else needs to know, a piece of paper in the mail. How do I get a digital version of my proof that I just got this degree and share it with other people, like potential employers or potential, you know, people who want to hire me? Or even just the internet in general, like how does anybody know that it's true about me? So these architectures that we're looking at use this self-sovereign identity distributed decentralized identifiers as a way to start sharing what's called verifiable claims. So the University of Texas is authoritative to say who's gone through the process, who's met the requirements of a degree and who has those degrees, and that they could issue in this sort of future, several years out, a digital version of the degree to me. And I would store it in my wallet, my digital wallet, and then I could share this claim issued by University of Texas with other people. And they would know it came from University of Texas, and they would know it was issued to them by me, like issued to me by them. So you need to start thinking about all the different types of things that we need to prove about ourselves to do all sorts of things in the world. And we get our birth certificates issued to us by the county in which we are born. We have all sorts of potentially licenses from the state because we go through a training process and are qualified to do a particular profession. There's a whole set of professions that require ongoing education and like, is one certification up to date or not? These are all sorts of things that we need to have this infrastructure to support the efficient and believable or trustable sharing of these types of things.
And there's intrinsic irony in there, though, because when you're saying that the way that they are proving now is by sending you a real piece of paper in the mail rather than doing it digitally, I mean, that's for somebody with skills and tools, that would have to be a ridiculously easy thing to counterfeit. Some piece of paper that says you were, I mean, I could do one up in Photoshop, but I wouldn't know that. I mean, most of the people I'd show it to wouldn't know that this is just a completely bogus document. There has to be some basis of trust somewhere. And the same thing with birth certificates. If John Best showed me his birth certificate, how on earth would I know if it was real or not? So digitally, it seems to me to be even more verifiable because you can trace things back.
So just real quick from a literary, what was that movie? It was based on a book, had Leonardo DiCaprio, and I think it was Tom Hanks chasing him. And he like pretended to be a pilot and he pretended to be a doctor. And
Catch Me If You Can, yes.
Yeah, and he basically did exactly what you're saying. He took advantage of the fact that, you know, the average pilot can, you know, not verify a pilot's license. I mean, they have numbers on things on there, but just
he
visually inspecting.
He actually flew airplanes. He just deadheaded.
But that's the thing. I mean, if you go to the dentist and he's a new dentist and the guy's starting to drill in my mouth, of course, there's somewhere in his office he's got a diploma framed on the wall. But we go in, I'm assuming that if he's got a dental office, that he must have gotten licensed somewhere and he must know what he's doing. So it's I don't know what to answer that. It's just one of those where our society is based on a lot of assumptions and trusts, but it's easy to fabricate things. And I'm sounding like a paranoid guy now.
That's what we love about you, Kevin. That's, you know, that's your whole, and this is where I was going to get to. So, Kalia, one thing that Kevin loves to do is he loves to take a concept like this, and this is how he writes books, and he's beaten it into me, which is, he'll add the words, and then something went wrong. So, you know, Kevin, what would you see going wrong with this sort of system? Like, you know, if you were going to use this as a minor subplot or even a plot in the book, you know, what's your feeling? Or do you feel like that, wow, this is kind of getting to the point where it would be boring? Like, well, I'm not going to write about this going wrong because it's pretty obvious. It's pretty fail-safe.
Well, I mean, one of the things that comes to mind, I'm sort of, you know, riffing off the top of my head, but you know, there have been all kinds of these science fiction stories where they create an android who's intelligent, and then there's a lawsuit about whether he is a human or not, or whether he has any rights or not. And and so I guess I would even go more digitally. What if somebody fabricates a completely bogus identity that is so fleshed out that it looks entirely real? What if that thing then hooks up with an AI, or what if an AI decides to get a driver's license, or you know, the whole concept of identity never used to be this complicated, and it just seems to me that there are so many million things that could go wrong, and we look back, our society is so reactive that we're running around on eggshells and duct tape, and everything is fine until somebody brings a bomb in his shoe on a plane. And then all of a sudden we realize, oh crap, that's a vulnerability that we never knew about. Mm-hmm. Or any number of these things that we're relying so much on that it seems like, I like what you're doing, Kalia, is in like being proactive and thinking about stuff like this rather than having it all fall apart and then us doing a postmortem and seeing what went wrong.
Yeah.
So, you know, from my perspective, as I hear you talk about that, one of the things that I've had some discussion about, and Kalia, I don't remember if I had it at the IIW or not, which is slang for the Internet Identity Workshop. But one thing we've been talking about is whenever we have these meetings down in Silicon Valley, you get to drive back and forth from your hotel to this place. And Kalia, you can attest with me, you pass what, 1 million Google self-driven, nobody in them cars, something like that. Everywhere you go, there's a self-driving car. And generally, there's literally nobody in it. One of the things that we had talked about is, could a car sort of have an identity? And would that car then be, if it had an identity, and she used a technical term earlier, she called it a decentralized identifier, which that decentralization is really important because what it implies is that it can't be correlated, right? You know, if we can pull it together, we want to be able to do a correlation around that to say, hey, we don't want anybody to discern that this is Kevin by correlating. Maybe on one site, you want to be anonymous, Kevin. You know, you want to go in there. You don't want anybody knowing you're an author or Kevin. You just want to be a fly on the wall. So you've created a new user. You're Bonsai J. Anderson, right? But then on another site, you're actually Kevin J. Anderson. And this identifier, unfortunately, leads to both. And so she talked about this decentralized identifier. And so one of the things we've talked about is, could autonomous cars be owned by multiple people in a decentralized fashion And so I think it kind of speaks to what you're talking about. But Kalia, I can't remember if I had that conversation with you or if you've had that discussion with other people.
Oh, about the identity of cars?
Yeah, well, just the identity of objects in general and things that, yeah.
Well, I think that in some ways, objects are much easier than people, right? Like, so one of the use cases that's being discussed is how do you track objects from their origins and creation to where they're consumed, right? And it's one thing to record the identity of like a banana in the blockchain as it moves from where it was grown to where it's eaten, or not even where it's eaten, where it's bought, to like, or container ships moving around globally, or, you know, things like that, where disclosure in a public way is probably okay. Whereas it's really critical that we support it, people only sharing information with the entities and institutions that they want to when they want to, and that we're not leaving linkable breadcrumbs everywhere we go.
John raised a really cool point that I hadn't really thought about, that we're all looking for a way to make sure that we have our one identity that is protected and we have it. But what about the other way around? What if you want more than one identity that isn't connected? So, just, for example, say you're a young woman who writes sweet kids puppy books or something, and you sell them to Christian bookstores, and that's your identity as Jenny who writes sweet puppy Christian books. Mm-hmm. But she also happens to be a dominatrix and is into S&M, and she has a big profile under a different name on those sites, which are perfectly legal, and she's doing that. Obviously, she doesn't want you to look up her identity to say she writes cute Christian puppy books and is also an S&M dominatrix. She clearly wants two completely separate identities, but it is the same human being.
Right. So I think one of the ironies of the complexities of understanding these new architectures, which is what I do with clients, is supporting them understand sort of this whole range of new possibilities, is that you have the capacity using this new infrastructure to create a different identifier and a different sort of private link between yourself and any other institution or any other person. So that you can literally keep every relationship separate. At the same time, if you choose to expose a particular public persona, you can keep that public persona separate from other public personas or personas available in particular contexts. But you as an individual have a holistic picture of all your different identities. But that the outside world, because of the way the underlying infrastructure for the identifiers is done, means that they're not publicly linkable or connectable. But for example, even in that use case, with your persona, prove that your age is over 21, but you don't want to reveal your birth date. So these tools also allow you to share what's called do selective disclosure, which is share a fact, like I'm over 18, but not the specific birth date or actual name. And right now in our paper or document world, there's no way to do that. You can't, you end up disclosing all the information on the artifact that you're using to prove the claim. And the cool thing about the digital world is you can start to prove things without revealing all of the information. Like, I'm currently licensed as a lawyer in California as a potential claim, but you don't have to reveal which of the lawyers you are, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, just other, all sorts of things like that, where there's a kind of new flexibility and capacity with these tools to do things that weren't possible in the paper-based world of identity.
Yeah, that's where I think, you know, Kevin, I'm glad I expanded your mind in that regard. you know, it's because I know that's something that, you know, that everybody kind of needs once in a while. Sometimes you want to make a comment and you know that the source of the comment can sort of, like someone might not tell you the truth. You know, that's probably your biggest fear if you're someone mm-hmm. like Kevin who, hey, I really want to ask a question here, but I don't want anybody sugarcoating it for me. I want to know the truth here. And I'm afraid that someone might decide, hey, they like my books. And rather than tell me the truth, they might try to curry favor by sugarcoating it. But we're about to close out here. So, Kalia, just a couple of things. So this has been fascinating. And I do agree that is your superpower. I'm picturing you with a big cape and it says like I on the back of it. So I know one of the things you're looking for as a new graduate in this is really, opportunities with corporations and people, because this will be the way of the world and the faster that people sort of get on board. So tell us a little bit about how people can find you if they want to work with you or learn more about this.
My website is a great place to start. It's identitywoman.net. And my email address is the same. It's my first name, Kaliya, @identitywoman.net. So those are my Twitter handle as well as got open DMs. I'm @identitywoman. So that's how you can find me. I'm working right now with companies of all sizes to explain this new innovative technology. I have a gig next week with a startup in Florida who's like, we're reading all this stuff online. It's kind of confusing. Will you come and explain it and how it fits into where we think our business is going? I'm very interested in supporting particularly women executives, but people in large companies who are trying to understand this space even before they start to engage a consultancy or their own development teams to really wrap their heads around this stuff. So I'm calling that knowledge coaching. I'm not a consultant in the sense of defining a project and telling you what to do. And it's more like personalized tutoring to really engage with the material, which is still really emerging. So those are the two things I'm doing right now with clients, and happy to talk with folks who are interested in engaging me.
Awesome. Well, we'll make sure all that's on the website. Kevin, did you have any final thoughts for Kalia, other than you're going to probably writing the chapter of your book where the AI becomes sentient and hits the singularity and creates its digital identity as we speak?
No, I was going to get the AI wants to form an identity for himself, and so he has to wait in line at the DMV, and it takes forever or something like that. But, in fact, you know, because normally John and I are sitting across the table and doing this podcast. So he's only assuming that this is really me right now, rather than
that's
like somebody who has a really good,
Kevin invitation. You're right. And I don't even know if that's Kalia. Actually, I do know that this is Kalia. I've heard her speak enough at the IAW. I'm 100% sure that's her. You, on the other hand, I'm a little concerned about.
Well, I think one of the great things that Kalia did here is that now I'm thinking about all kinds of things that I hadn't thought about before. And it's just really cool stuff. And it's our technology and it's our society that is moving at warp speed. So I'm glad people really smart like you are thinking about it ahead of time.
Thanks.
Well, Kalia, thanks for joining us. I hope you'll come back sometime soon. And if anybody wants to find her, it's identitywoman.net. We will have all that on the website. Take care, everyone.
You've been listening to Creative Futurism with Kevin J. Anderson and John Best. For more information, go to creativefuturism.com. Thank you.